Welcome to the Ghostbusters Crybaby edition of the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me is my co-host and rock aficionado.
Chad Metz, I don't know how much of a aficionado I am these days.
Yeah, well, you're an aficionado on Dwayne. You know all things Dwayne, so
I know a lot, yeah.
including his love of Memphis Championship Wrestling and his desire to play random concert gigs at Target.
Dwayne. Oh, man.
So, Chad, I've seen a movie. I've seen a movie that I care very deeply about, from a franchise I care very deeply about. If longtime fans of this podcast will know that I ranted for a good long time in anticipation of the movie that is now known as Answer the Call. So my love of Ghostbusters is very well documented. We got a new Ghostbusters movie, and it is making money at the box office. Your thoughts on just the generalized overtones about the movie on film Twitter?
So I was happy to see it make money. Not because I am, the biggest Ghostbuster fan, but anytime one of these movies comes out, I want to see that it does well because that's going to help with the overall theater experience. So last I saw, I think it was making about 45
48.
million, 48, okay. And I think that's like the highest for a Ghostbusters movie. Or like,
No, answer the call was higher, but had no legs, and so it died fairly quickly.
okay.
The key to Afterlife was it had an opening similar to this, then had legs for like 8 weeks after because it was a December movie that dragged into the dead days of January.
Yeah, so yeah, we'll see how the legs do, but I'm encouraged that, at least it opened well. As for opinion about the movie that I've seen online, I guess mixed is what I would say. I've seen everything from, it's I've seen people that love it. I've seen people that are like, this movie kind of pushed aside the thing that made Afterlife good, which was the new family aspect. In exchange for, bringing back the established stars and whatnot, and I've seen people that just don't like it. The most intriguing thing that I heard was that I saw was someone say that this felt more like an episode of the cartoon
Which was
than,
the intent.
like a go prop like a Ghostbusters movie, which is more appealing to me as more of a fan of the cartoon than the movies, but I don't know how that pans out with Ghostbusters solely movie fans, because I know there are some of those as well as
Heretofore to be known as the Ghost Head Crybabies.
I would have before this, I would have just thought if you were a Ghostbusters fan, you probably liked everything, including the cartoons, and hearing that a movie was going to closely incorporate the cartoon would have been like music to your ears.
I just, I've always taken the tact of the old line from the People versus George Lucas. I didn't ask for awesome Star Wars. I just asked for more Star Wars. And I got more Star Wars. Paul Feig gets a lot of crap on the internet, and I understand why. But a lot of the things that happened with Answer the Call were outside of his control. And I'm forever going to be indebted to that man because he did a thing I didn't think would ever happen in my lifetime, which is he got back Ghostbusters back on the big screen. Like crazy Uncle Dan set up in the Hamptons for 20, 30 years trying to get a Ghostbusters 3 off the ground, couldn't do it. And Paul Feig got it done in 2 years. And I was happy about that, and I was pleased about that. And as I said on the podcast when we reviewed it, if there had never been a thing called Ghostbusters and you were just introducing this as a fresh new concept and it wasn't our existing IP, people would have actually liked it more. I'm forever indebted to Paul Feig, and I'm glad Answer the Call exists. Like, I don't really understand the animosity and the perilousness, I guess, in the run-up, because, to be quite frank, everything from the premiere onward online was giving me Rise of Skywalker vibes, which scared the crap out of me, because I'm like, no, this is not good. And when you've got fanboys out there, crybabies out there, who are like, everybody rally around this movie and go see it as an FU to the critics who don't know shit about our wonderful product and our great IP and what a masterwork this is and everything else, you start getting concerned. Like, me and you have lived through enough Snyder Bro shenanigans to be concerned when you start seeing that kind of stuff pop up around the internet. The movie isn't that. The movie isn't horrible. The movie isn't bad. The movie doesn't suck. It's different from Afterlife, but anything they did was going to be different from Afterlife, because Afterlife is solely dependent upon the heart of the ghost of Harold Ramis. And Harold Ramis as a spirit being incorporated throughout that entire film. And you can't replicate that magic, because while the first one is for Harold, this one is for Ivan. And Ivan was not a on-screen presence. He was a behind-the-scenes presence as the director. And so you don't feel that that missing element to it. Because it's his freaking son, you know, writing the movie and producing it. So, it isn't the worst. It isn't a Attack of the Killer Donuts fiasco. But it's not, you know, as heartfelt as your life. And I think that...
I think that should be okay. I mean, you're not going to get knocking out the park every time. And if it okay, can be okay. Now,
especially when you go 30 years in between movies.
Right.
Like, think about the fact that we're going to have 3 Ghostbusters movies in 7 years or 8 years, as opposed to 2 Ghostbusters movies over the course of 30 years.
It's true. It's true. On that note, I did see a bit of trivia. So Dan Aykroyd has been
a Ghostbuster in 5 movies, one of which wasn't even a Ghostbusters movie, because he made a cameo in the 1995 Casper movie that no one remembers.
That is it. Because he was in the Paul Feig Ghostbuster movie, but not as a Ghostbuster. So
as a cab driver that was randomly named something else.
Yeah, no, yeah, they all were. But if I didn't see the answer, I probably would have got it, because that cameo like sticks out the most to me of any like pre-2000s kind of cameo movie we've had. This is like, because it was also kind of weird, because it was like the Ghostbusters, like, I mean, Ray was scared of stuff, but he was like, would he really be scared of them? Those 3 bozos, he would have been scared of them.
This is the dude who got scared of the librarian. So, I mean, like, and there's some nice callbacks there that I think you'll appreciate when you see the movie. But he also is rocking that 90s stash as well cameo, which is kind of also out there. I just like it and appreciate it because, if I'm quite honest, Casper has some ties to this movie. And I think that that's just an interesting parallel that's a fact.
Interesting. I'm really curious about that point now.
So, good or bad or not so good? Take it away, Chad. Pilot the podcast.
All right. So we normally go over what, you know, the good, what we liked, the bad, what we didn't like, and the not so good. You know, the kind of stuff we're met on for movies. Normally it's when we both see it, but I have not seen Frozen Empire. So this is going to be an all Brian thoughts on Ghostbusters stuff. And I'm immune to spoilers, so he can carry, he can take it away. But everyone else, at this point on, spoiler cast. So if you don't want to be spoiled on Ghostbusters, this is your chance to click out of it. Don't complain in the comments. We're telling you right now. So spoiler start now. Okay. So let's start with the good first, and then we'll work our way to the bad stuff.
McKenna Grace. This movie, like, I was wondering, like, when I walked out of Afterlife, I was like, look, if we get a sequel, I need this girl to be the lead focus of that sequel. And they did it. For all the other pomp and circumstance and craziness and the animated series references and the references to the first two movies and the original Ghostbusters coming back and making his way up to Mayor and all the things, like, they made it a story about her. And she was the strongest performance out of anybody in Afterlife. And the fact that she gets to lead this movie, lead it very well, and gives just a profound performance is awesome to me. Say what you want to. Ghostbusters 1 and 2 are straight-up comedies, and so is Answer the Call. I kind of feel Afterlife and now Frozen Empire fall more into the genre of dramedies. Because, yes, there are comedic beats and certainly a lot of laughs. But at its heart, Afterlife is a movie about death and about grief and about loss and how to come to terms with that grief and loss and the regrets of never having made amends for the things that have gone on in your life that, you know, went unsaid. And the same thing here, this is a movie about coming of age, but it's also a movie about identity. Who am I? What makes me me? And what is my place in the world? And I think those are very universal themes, very poignant themes. And in both cases, I think Kim McKenna Grace rocks them both very, very well. It's hilarious that the world looks at these movies like, oh, Finn Wolfhead, Stranger Things. And I'm like, yeah, but he's the comedic side relief big brother. Like, she's the one. She's the focus. She's the Ghostbuster. And her performance is nothing short of astounding. Especially considering that she has a new best friend who is a ghost. And not just any ghost. A 16-year-old female ghost, just like she is a 16-year-old girl. And there's some slight tensions there that are very, like, nuanced, but they very much seem to be, I'm going to, like, release my soul onto the eternal plane for 2 minutes so we can hook up kind of vibe, which is very weird. But it all works. And it works because she's really compassionate. She's really, really vulnerable as an actress. And she, and the director in this particular instance, got a really great performance out of her, and I can't wait if we get a third one to see where they go, because she'll be of age, which a big part of this was, hey, you got a 15-year-old or 16-year-old running around with a potential nuclear weapon on her back. Like, what the hell are you thinking?
Okay, so hearing this whole thing, particularly the girl best friend part, you said it worked, so I trust you saying that, but nothing about anything you said sounds like anything that should work or that anything that anybody should be cool with. So I'm really curious how this is pulled off. I know I probably just have to see it to understand it, but it just sounds completely wild. And like
Christina Ricci kissing a boy who's just come back to life after being dead for 30 years also would classify as very weird, and no one would understand how that works.
You know, that is a great ass point, because I never thought of it like that. I don't know. Maybe it's because I know who Casper is. And at the point of the kiss, he was a living, breathing boy. It was just like, you know, kiss, click, Casper. So I think that scene, that makes it more acceptable in my mind because I've seen it. But then again, this is kind of the same thing if the ghost is going to be like, I'm gonna make myself real, and then we can do some things.
Or no, it's
But
her. It's the exact opposite. It's her saying, I want to release my particles and vape and be on the eternal plane for 2 minutes so that we can know each other better. That's the term she uses, so that we can learn more about one another.
Okay. So I misunderstood it. This is even wilder to me now because essentially the kid
they
is
have
like,
a machine. They have a machine that can take an objects that are inhibited by a ghost, suck the ghost out of the object, and transplant the ghost into its own tube, and then it then gets sucked into what essentially amounts to a giant trap. And then the object is just, you know, it's a CD player, or it's a chair, or a clock, or whatever. See what I'm saying? She decides that while it hasn't been tried on humans, living humans, she wants to be the first test subject because her new best friend is a ghost and she needs to understand her better and get on her ethereal plane.
Okay. So I'm glad you explained it because it kind of takes me off of where I was going, which to me sounded like, so I'm going to temporarily off myself just so we can hook up and then I'm going to come back.
This for 2 minutes.
This makes it seem like, okay, she's not technically off. I mean, I know either way she's not technically offing herself, but this makes it sound a lot better. That's essentially what she's doing. She is, I'm going to voluntarily commit temporary suicide so I can do some ghost things with you and then go back. Even though I don't know if I can actually go back and I might just be off of myself for real. You know. Bet 1,000, shoot 1,000. Let's roll with it. All right.
And then when she finally does ascend to the ethereal plane and get on the same level with Ghost Girl, who should show up and bust out of his little orb but our primary villain, who needed her to speak the evil language that opens up the orb so that he may wreak his havoc on New York City. And so her ghost best friend was working with him the entire time to bust him out of the orb because she wants to go home to be with her family, who she may or may not have accidentally burned alive.
All right. Okay. The more we talk about this, the more I'm like, what the deuce? And you know what? I see the line. I'm going to stop right there. Cool. Cool. Ghost stuff. I can date.
Feel free. Ask questions because this is the good of the film.
How long into the movie does this happen? Because if you're unleashing the big bad from this, how long does it take till we get to that?
It's an hour and 45 minutes into the two hour movie.
Oh, so the big bad is basically not doing anything until the very end.
Right. And it's a very truncated third act. And that's part of I think what some people's problem with it is that you're building and building and building. You're dumping a bunch of info and you're dumping a bunch of exposition. And you finally let the dude out of this tube. And now you've all got to kind of scramble and rush to get this thing done in a very short amount of time. And so I think that's a legitimate criticism, I guess, of the movie or the way the movie is structured. But yeah, like the betrayal happens like I want to say an hour and 40 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes into the movie. It takes a hot minute.
Okay. And it's a 2 hour movie?
Something like that. It feels like 2.5 because of everything that's in it, in the pacing. And we'll get to some of that here later on. But yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on from the good so far.
No, Chad, ask me more questions because this is my favorite part of the movie is the fact that there's a pseudo-sexual lesbian relationship between a 16-year-old girl and a ghost that ends with the girl, you know, betraying her because she wants to go home and see her family that she may or may not have burned alive. Like, her signifying object is the set of matches she used or may not have used to burn her parents alive.
See, my, when the more you keep talking about it, I know you keep saying this is good. My brain keeps saying nothing about this sounds right. And that's why it keeps making me want to go to something else. Because it's like, this has got to fall into the one of the other two categories. This can't be like the creme de la creme of this thing. But okay. But again, I don't really know what else to ask. I kind of feel like I know where we go from there. They, you know, defeat old buddy, and maybe does the friend like actually help them in the end after? Yeah. See, I've seen that part of the movie before.
Yeah, and then she ascends to her eternal plane to be with her people, who she may or may not have burned alive.
Okay, so for the lack of a better term, do they have any ghost action once the turn, after the turn happens, and she comes
they
back?
Look
and
longing. They look longingly into each other's eyes as she evaporates and becomes part of the universe, and have a very Jack and Rose type, I will always be around you in the universe type thing.
Okay. All right. I guess I can dig that. All the other
she
stuff.
She literally says at one point, it's a shame that the only person in the world that fully understands me is a 16-year-old ghost.
I'm amazed that with given the discourse that we have on social media with people having problem with stuff, I'm amazed nobody has said anything about this so far. This seems like the kind of stuff that's rife for certain type of people hammering home, because I mean, you can apply this to whatever you want, and most of those people apply to the right thing but have the wrong reaction to it. But I've heard nobody say anything about it.
Yeah, because it's not the most publicized or well marketed point of part of the movie.
Is that character in the trailers?
No.
Okay. So,
and it is a fully CG character who is on screen for a good 30 to 45 minutes of the movie. I'm sure it did not help the budget.
Is it a known actor?
Yeah, it looks like it. I don't really, like, I know her from things, but I don't know where she's from exactly.
Okay. I'm not going to kill space looking that up while we talk, but I'll find it before the show's over. Okay. All right. I'm going to move us to something else. Wait, do you have any other good besides McKenna Grace and the freaky deaky ghost stuff?
Paul Rudd literally quoting the lyrics of Bustin' Makes Me Feel Good to Carrie Coon's character in the firehouse with Slimer floating around, which, by the way, Finn Wolfhard's whole purpose in this film is to have beef with Slimer, who's just, at this point, an old ghost that lives in the attic of the firehouse and is just surrounded by tons and tons of candy wrappers.
How much is Slimer in the movie?
Well, I'd say about 8 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
They keep doing this. It's the gag bit where they, like, he goes up to try and catch Slimer, and Slimer outwits him. Then he goes back again to try again, and Slimer outwits him. And finally, on the third try, he gets him, kind of thing.
Okay. Oh, so Slimer goes in a trap.
Eventually.
And anything else happened to good old Slimer?
No, because he doesn't have his 7 Slimer children that he had in one of those movies. I can't remember which one. Answer the Call.
Yeah. So, you know, the one that doesn't exist anymore.
So all says right. Ernie Hudson, of all people.
good old Ernie.
I'm very happy for Ernie, because they make him the bankrolling entrepreneur, the philanthropist, keeping the Ghostbusters alive.
I knew that. I saw that going in, that Ernie, that Winston Zeddemore got money and is like the guy in this universe. I'm like, good for you. The guy that they kind of pushed out of the first one, because reasons, he gets some come up in the sequel, and that's I appreciate that. Let's see, anything, any other good stuff?
That dude, like the Paul Rudd doing that is just awesome, because it's Paul Rudd being Paul Rudd, and that's just what I love and what I need out of that character.
Yeah, Paul Rudd's awesome.
Yeah,
All
because
right.
I just don't really care about him becoming a dad and what the dad role means in a mixed home and all that kind of stuff and his, mine, and ours and all that. Like, I don't, that stuff doesn't matter to me. Like, I don't need to see him grow on a character journey where he becomes quote unquote dad. They do it and they do it fine, but like, that's not my, like, it's not the biggest thing in the world to me.
All right, so we're going to move on. We'll just go in order. We won't go to the super bad. We're going to go to the not so good. What was your not so good about this movie?
Exhibition and the, I would say the exposition dumps. Patton Oswalt exists solely to provide an exposition dump. And multiple people, multiple times, they provide information dumps that are very nuanced and complex. One of the things that I love about the Phantom Menace, the Phantom Menace DVD, is George provided audio commentaries for all three of those movies when they released on DVD. And on the DVD for Phantom Menace, he talks about the dinner table scene on Tatooine, where they're talking to Anakin and his mom, and Jar Jar goes to grab the thing with his tongue, and Qui-Gon grabs the tongue. Lucas says, look, this is an exposition dump. It's one of the easiest ways we could find to get the information in a setting that wasn't overwhelming. Every movie has to have one. This is just how we chose to do ours. But it's only one. There's two, possibly three exposition dumps in this movie. And at some point, that's a little bit too much lure to be dumping on people's heads, you know, when you're trying to, like, make everything work. Villain design would also for me be in the realm of the not so good. It's unique, it's different, very similar to the villain of the week type things you would have gotten with the animated series, but it's not practically there till the last 10 minutes of the movie. And so you don't, like, it's a foreboding sense of fear, but like they don't physically tangibly appear until 10 minutes left, 10, 20 minutes left in the movie. And therefore it's hard to really like get a good shot of them and get the look right and where they feel dominant and imposing. It was not a great CG render on the villain. You know, the ghost lesbian lover, awesome. Did really well. The horned tooth crazy lady, a crazy person, not so much. But it's also the first Ghostbusters movie I can think of that starts with a flashback. Like, we start in like 1908 New York, like with firefighters coming out of, you know, the Hook and Ladder 8. So it's also unique in that sense. I just feel like there was a lot of lure that was dumped on people's heads, and you're just expected to kind of pick it up and roll with it in amongst lesbian ghost and family problems and Finn Wolfhead trying to corral ghost yet Casper and Ernie Hudson and Dan Aykroyd having a conversation about how they want to spend their golden years, and Ernie Hudson basically tell him to shut up and stop being a weird freak and start, you know, go on a beach somewhere and relax, because he's just making his things harder on everybody. So yeah, that would be my not so good of the film.
Okay. So what is the villain's name? I think we can say that.
Raza, like it's some kind of Raza something. It's the whole thing is that, like, it's one of those Egyptian god type deals where, like, this guy went a little bit nuts. And so because he went nuts, we broke his horns off because the horns were what gave him all of his power. And we put him in a trap. And we are the fire wielders. The fire wielders are the ones that trapped him because he's an ice god. And so the fire wielders trapped him and passed the orb down from person to person, surrounded by brass, and passed down his horns. And, eventually. So, what's old boy's name from Eternals? The guy who guy's also in Obi-Wan Kenobi as Fate Jedi. The one that does the big dance number because he's an Indian film star.
Kumail Nanjiani.
The whole set of action sequences is thrown off. It starts rolling because that dude is looking to sell his grandmother's possessions because she's dead and wants to sell this orb for as much as he possibly can. Knowing what it is, he just tries to sell it and spin it off.
Okay, so
So
he
that's how
knows.
the whole thing starts. And then eventually, Chad, eventually, that leads to that dude wielding a what I can only call a golden shredder outfit, using his firepower that he has now been trained to use by Rey to harness and fight back against the evil ice monster.
Okay, so he's a descendant. It turns out to be one of these fire people that are guarding this ice ghost. And he knows all this at the start of the movie. And so instead of living up to that duty, he decides, F it, I need some money. And
Basically, this dude is willing to sell literally anything in his apartment or his grandmother's apartment to make money.
all right. So, and I assume the thing has to get the horn. Wait, no, wait. You told me the whole thing with the, you have to say the evil word. So he doesn't need his horns to actually be released. He needs somebody to come and say the evil word from the living
Which
to the dead.
the
So.
interesting part of that is that there's a whole set piece that we'll get to in the bad that's set at the New York Public Library that is based around Patton Oswalt giving them a copy of the Gregorian chant that opens up the orb to that's from the flashback scene at the beginning of the movie.
I forgot.
So he either could you either could have opened the orb by playing this recording of a vinyl record from 1908, or you could have done it his way and inhabited a human being to utter the words. But he can't have control over human beings. He can only have control over the dead. So when old girl wants to go on to the eternal plane to be with her lesbian lover, that's when he makes his move and gets her to say the words. Like either way, he was going to be released from his prison. And then once he was released from his prison, he was going to go to old boy's sect dungeon, which is surrounded by brass and where his horns are being kept, sweep on in there, take his horns and reattach them, and then start making his way to the firehouse. Because the firehouse, as pointed out in the original movie, is a delineation mark between the living and the dead. Like it has supernatural whatever.
Okay. I don't know what to do with that. So just gonna carry on. So
So, like
is
the orb is being kept in this room, surrounded by not copper, but it's some sort of metal, and that's what the orb is made of, and the orb is surrounded by that. The orb is surrounded by that on a pedestal. So this dude had to remove it from the pedestal to put it in a little box and give it to Ray.
Does he and does he ever explain why he did it outside of he just wants money?
Nope, he just says he wants money and didn't really know how powerful the orb was. He knew there was probably some reason his grandmother kept guarding it as tightly as she did.
Wow. Okay. Whatever. Okay. So Anything else within that realm of, not so good?
Peck becoming mayor. Peck basically chewing the parents out for allowing a 16-year-old to have a nuclear weapon on her back doing all these things. Peck holding a grudge for 40 years, like against the Ghostbusters, waiting to shut them down again because it went so well the first time. I mean, I can't remember if it was the first time or the second time the Titanic finally made it to New York. I think that was the second time.
It feels like the second time. Yeah, let's go the
Because
second
they,
time.
yeah, because they make that joke about the Titanic, better late than never. But like, oh, and that's another thing. They canonically like recognize Ghostbusters too. Like they show footage of the Statue of Liberty like walking down the boulevard and the whole thing.
Oh, okay. So, two questions. How much of Peck is in the movie? And does he get his comeuppance again? I guess this is, I have
He
three
gets his
questions.
comeuppance. He gets his comeuppance, but it's more Ernie Hudson's character who gives him his comeuppance. And there's not enough interaction for me between Peck and Bill Murray. Because that was the whole dynamic in the original, was Bill Murray was just gonna be a complete douchebag to this dude, and they were gonna give tit for tat, and it was gonna be funny. Like he gives one line and that's it. There's a lot on the cutting room floor with Murphy. We know this from the trailers, which is a very odd notion to cut Bill Murray out of a Ghostbusters movie or cut his role down. But yeah, that's it. Peck is like forced into a corner when they rescue the city of New York for a third time. And he's like, this is it. You've destroyed the city. You've done all these horrible things. And the news camera people show up and are like, so how are you going to thank the Ghostbusters for saving the city? And then he's like,
Oh, crap.
well, actually, we have the keys to the city here for our good friends, the Ghostbusters.
Boy. Okay, and next question. Is Sigourney Weaver in this movie?
Nope.
Interesting. Do they mention her?
I stuck around for the post credit because I was like, that's what they did the last time.
Yep.
Like they had this the end of the credit where it's like in Sigourney Weaver, and you're like, wait, she wasn't in the body of the movie. And then they do that whole sweet little bit with her and Bill Murray. She's not in this one. But yeah, that's not a thing that happens.
Okay, and no mention of her or Oscar or any of that
No. Mm-mm.
crap.
But they do acknowledge that the Statue of Liberty once marched down the streets in what they call the last great destruction of New York City.
Okay. That's
Because I don't know
really
if you've ever met the Statue of Liberty, she leaves quite a footprint.
cool. That's pretty cool to have that kind of like event name. Okay, so if there's no more, sort of good. What's your bad? What's really wrong with this movie?
Exposition is really up there for me. This is a lot of information. I mean, it's not my standard for like the worst I've ever seen was the three or two of the three Fantastic Beasts movies where like J.K. Rowling is doing this information dump that like works really well in a Harry Potter book. Because if you get confused about what Horcruxes are, you can go back and read a couple of times for you to figure it out. Then a movie, you get this whole exposition dump about this guy and Dumbledore being related in some kind of strange, crazy way. And you have to do it and explain it in like 10 minutes and be gone. So like it's not to that level, but it's still very dense. And again, there's so many moving plates. There's so much going on that it's hard to kind of like juggle all of that. But my straight up bad would be this the New York City Library piece. There's a Ernie Hudson's character has built a substation. It's a submersible place underground, like a subway station, abandoned subway station type thing. And he's used it to turn into their research lab. They've essentially taken Egon's idea for ghost storage and expanded it because, you know, eventually you were going to run out of room in the containment unit. And so in that, that's where you get the ghost machine. You learn about the ghost machine that can take objects and suck the ghost out of it and put it into the trap. But you also have a place where they're housing ghosts for study, quote unquote. And guess, you know, of course, whenever we got our big bad who comes around, he, you know, lets them out because he needs buddies to help. And one of them is a, what do you call that? His whole thing is he's a ghost that takes over you, like takes over whatever host he is in. And so in the New York City thing, he steals that little, he pops himself after the exposition dump by Peyton Oswald, into an object. He then gets that recording thing, and then they all go on this chase through the New York City Library, take a sweet detour for Dan to see his former librarian ghost, who's still up there, by the way. They also say that Dan Aykroyd has been banned from the New York Public Library since that incident, which doesn't really make any sense to me. Like, they became famous after that. Like, why wouldn't you have invited these guys to come take care of your ghost problem at some point instead of just letting her, you know, hang around the shelves for the last 30 years? They follow him, then now there's a chase, and then Chad, it bounces into the famous New York Stone Lions, and the Stone Lions start jumping around, and they start having a battle, trying to pin down Dan Aykroyd, and then McKenna Grace gets into the tripod, you know, the little, you remember that thing Indiana Jones and his dad rode around in, that motorcycle with the cabbie next to attached to it? Yeah. Jumped into one of those and then pulls out the proton pack and is trying to shoot the stone lion, and it makes the whole deal. And it's like just a weird set piece that doesn't really do anything except be weird with like lions coming to life, and you don't really know what happened to the recording or if they ever got it back or what happened to it. And so it really practically serves no purpose other than to be comedic relief after your giant exposition dump. And it was not great. The other thing that was not great to me is trying to force this family dynamic. It's not that I don't care about the family characters. Like, I care very much about the new generation of characters. And I actually think they do a good job of balancing the old cast with the new cast. My issue is trying to make Paul Rudd a dad and trying to force it, and then like having it happen. Like the big ending is like McKenna Grace randomly saying dad, you know, for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, sweet, I get that. But it doesn't really work. And it's just kind of weird because you're trying, at one point they make him be the bad guy in a good cop, bad cop situation. And it's like, that's not who you are personality wise. And like, they try and rectify it by having, you know, your dad, you know, the kind of conversations you have to have with your kid from time to time. And then you go back and you say, you apologize and you try to make it right and help them know that you're trying to teach them the right way and yada, yada. So they try to rectify it that way, but it really doesn't work. And then the creme de la creme of the crazy for me, or the bad for me, is the idea that we go through this trope of heroes not being heroic, like having their superpowers taken away. You're a Superman fan. They deal with this in the Superman comics all the time. What is Clark without the powers? Yeah, like, if you take the powers away from him, what is he? And how does he react? And what does that mean? And how does he relate to being human and all these things? They do the same thing here, because Peck gets her suspended from being a Ghostbuster. And mom and dad start taking it very seriously. They're like, no, no, you're not going to go with us on this mission because you need to stay home. And, you know, we're protecting you. We're doing this for you so you can go be a kid. And she's like, screw that. I'm I'm a born and raised Ghostbuster. Like, this is my career. Like, you aren't even a scientist. You're just a blonde chick. She literally tells her mother, I'm a scientist. You're a blonde chick. Like, I'm sorry. Like, this is my career. You're just a daughter of somebody. Like, I like you don't need this as much as I do. And that's great. But at some point along the way, you have to go on a journey because of that. Like, you have to find, because the purpose of taking away the power is to help you identify who you are outside of that thing. Like, athletes go through this all the time. Who am I outside of being an outstanding quarterback? Like, I only get to play sports at my very best, at my peak, for like the first 35 years of my life. After that, I've got a whole long life to live, and I can't do that thing anymore. So what am I outside of being a quarterback? They tried to do that with her with being a Ghostbuster. What am I outside of being a Ghostbuster? But the entire freaking movie is about her doing Ghostbusters things without like caring about anything. And it's like she never really fully steps back. She never really learns an identity outside of being a Ghostbuster. And in the end, she goes back to being a Ghostbuster. So, like, what was the point for doing the whole restriction thing except to open up the door for her lesbian friend to come in and wow her off her feet?
Okay, so I've heard you talk about the dynamic, the family dynamic. You haven't really touched on the legacy characters coming back at all in any of your sections. So what did you think about them?
They handle it uniquely. They're there and they're supporting. And it's very odd for me to see Dan Aykroyd being a supporting player in a Ghostbusters movie, because it is primarily the way they cut it. It is primarily him and Ernie Hudson. And Dan Aykroyd as a person excels at the weird conspiracy theory, crazy pseudo history stuff. Like, that's the whole thing that he's always been into, going back all the way to the 70s, which, by the way, they announced today that the Live from New York movie that they're going to do is going to be in the 90 minutes leading up to the first episode of Saturday Night Live, which is going to be awesome because I loved Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, and that's basically what every episode of Studio 60 was. But that's Ackroyd has a history of that going all the way back. So having him deal with these objects and the occult and the possession of them and the occult and this history of Greek or Egyptian or whatever heritage you want is really cool and it works really well. But it doesn't lend itself to the conversation with him and Ernie about the golden years doesn't resonate as well with me because this is just who Dan is. This is who his character is and always has been. Like, he turned the shop into the storefront into a ghost paraphernalia shop. Like, and you can, and one of the things that I wish they would have done, honestly, and they don't do, because they kind of tease for a little while that he might die in this one. But what I wish they would have done would have been focus more on the fact that Ray truly misses being a Ghostbuster. That he loves being in the office, he loves doing the occult. He loves dealing with the artifacts and talking history, but he misses the thrill of suiting up. And I don't think they really pushed that as well as they could. Ernie can take or leave suiting up. Bill Murray can take or leave suiting up. But it is a life for Ackroyd's character, the way it is for McKenna Grace's character. And it's one of the things that bonds the two of them together when she's quote unquote benched. Because he tells her, well, I could help you, but aren't you supposed to be benched? And she looks at him and she says, aren't you supposed to be effing retired? And she's like, a fair point. I don't know, like, I really wish they would have done that differently, and I wish I would have gotten more Bill Murray than I did. He randomly pops up at one point to give a test, and then randomly pops up with his sunshades and during an ice storm at the end for the third act, and there's nothing really in between. And Janine, it's great to see Annie Potts have something to do, and it's great for her to suit up because that's a large part of the animated series. She doesn't. None of them really do that much, if it makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah. Then,
like, it's a collective effort of all of them, but it's McKenna Grace who comes up with the idea of how to stop person. And it's her plus her ghost girlfriend who ultimately are responsible for taking Ice Dude out. So.
Interesting. Only because, how you just said it's McKenna Grace and Ghost Girl that pretty much come up with it. My question was always going to be, how are the legacy characters used? And hearing people decry Ghostbusters as becoming, you know, like as you said, it was a comedy at first. Now you're saying like a dramedy, and I've heard people say like it's like a family, you know, a light family drama now. But is there a point to having the legacy characters come back anymore?
Yeah, because it help it, it's a bridge, particularly for Phoebe, for McKenna Grace's character, between the family that she has and the family that she's found. And Ray and is particularly very much Egon. You know, Ray and Egon were very, very close in the first two films.
Right.
And Ray is particularly hurt by the way that Egon just packs up and leaves. And it's Ray who apologizes to Ghost Egon about, sorry, I didn't believe you. And so I think he takes it personally to look after McKenna and like guide her on her journey. And there's a reason why that's who she goes to when she wants to figure this thing out. So, I mean, it'll be interesting. But I don't think they don't serve a purpose. I think it's a link between this family that she has and this family that she's found, a link between her mom and her granddad. Right. And like I said, the underdeveloped part of that is Ray's desire to get back in the suit and Ray's eagerness to actually bust Ghost.
Okay, so I think that Ray wanting to, you know, continue that, I can see why you put that in here. But going forward, should they, like, they have a purpose. I kind of said that wrong in the question, but they have a purpose. But do we need them in the suits anymore? Do we just need them just to be, like, you know, who they are, what they represent, but the new cast is doing all this other stuff. So these guys are basically, I mean, maybe outside of Ernie, because Ernie's like, you know.
Ernie's bankrolling it and Ernie's providing them with the technology. He's basically Q at this point.
Yeah.
And Dan is just, that's who she is. That's who he is. Like, and I think you don't necessarily need them in the suits every time because you've gotten that twice. I think you do need them to be mentors to her.
Yeah.
Especially as she grows into adulthood and what it means to be a Ghostbuster, you know, and run something as an adult. Which, again, is what my why I expressed my frustration over the idea of taking it away from her so she learns what she is outside of it and her never really giving it up.
Yeah, it sounds like we're kind of on the same page with this. I don't think they, I think they should be there. Mentor status is a good call. But they don't think we need them in the suits anymore. I mean, putting them in the suits was like a way to ride nostalgia and get people back invested in Ghostbusters.
Putting them in the suits was necessary for the ending of Afterlife. Putting them in the suits here is necessary to aid and abet the threat that is present. Because you've done so little digging and so little emphasis on who this guy is and why they're a threat that, you know, the painting got more detailed than this guy. And to make it seem like the old team and the new team together with all their smarts and technology are getting their asses kicked. It just emphasizes how badass this dude is in the 5 minutes of screen time he has.
Enough on that subject. Anything else that you found like really bad? Anything else that kind of stuck out to you?
Really, for me, it was just the fact that like this was, there was so much here, and there was so, the movie was trying to do so much. And I feel like at times it got away from the heart of what it was supposed to be, which is a character study of McKenna Grace coming of age and finding herself and finding her love and finding her passion for what she does and fighting for her families, both the found family and the family that she was born into. And I think that it kind of veers away from that at time to time. And I really, really did not care for the Umanji like comedic relief character, because I'm like, this is like a whole side thing I don't need. Like, yeah, like you needed that element of it to contain him or whatever, because it took a literal village to beat this guy. But like, I liked him more in Obi-Wan Kenobi, where he is a, you know, con man who actually does believe and gets guilted into helping because he does want to help because he hates the Empire. There was more nuance there. This is not a nuanced character. This is just a comedic relief character, much like Rick Moranis' character. That's actually the first thing I thought of, was Rick Moranis' character suiting up and shooting the shell. And then once the shell gets broken, everybody hails him as a hero when he actually did nothing but shoot proton lasers at this shell. You know, it was the same kind of thing.
Speaking of him, if there was a time for Rick Moranis to come back, I think, you know, this would have probably been the time. So who knows?
The closest we've gotten was in 2019 when Disney Plus was announced and they were going to do a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV series for Disney Plus, and he was agreeing to come out of retirement for that. But that fell through, and then the Josh Gad thing fell through. And so I don't think we'll ever see Moranis on TV or on film ever again.
And that's not the worst thing in the world. He went away for his own reason, so that's fine.
Yeah, he's very much a Gene Wilder in that sense. After Gilda died, Gene just kind of secluded to himself.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't know that Old Boy from the Bear was his grandson, question mark?
The lead?
Yep.
Is he?
That's what I understand.
Because he reminds me a lot of Gene. Every time I look at him, I'm like, if you're going to do a Willy Wonka, he should probably be Willy Wonka. If you want to do a tad more serious, that's probably the dude. So, man.
Instead, we just got Timothy Clement singing and dancing his heart away.
All right, so anything else with
I want movie? Another one. I need another one. I need this movie to make enough money for me to get an actual Ghostbusters trilogy and to see McKenna Grace, because we're not going to have a lot of time. Like, Wolfhead and McKenna Grace are getting older. Like, there's a time limit when you're dealing with younger actors. But I need one more. If you want to dig into the lure of the animated series, but like, I need one more. And I need to see her finish this out as an adult, carrying on like the legacy and fighting her own battles and setting it up in a place where if Sony wants to revisit this every 3 to 5 years, they possibly can. I don't necessarily know if that means Reitman Jason directing or not. I do know it'll mean him executive producing and writing, but I'd like to see where this goes, honestly, because you're going to stay in New York, obviously, now. You're going to stay with the staple of the firehouse. But where do you find the threat? And how's that all come about is the interesting part.
If you get another one, it's all going to depend on the money. So that's why this weekend is hopeful. I think they
Well,
will.
and that's why the legs are the big deal, because Kong versus Godzilla is coming, but I don't know that that's going to take away from that audience.
I'm really curious how that movie's gonna do.
Yeah, especially considering the last one was released in the middle of the pandemic, literally like April, March or April of 2020.
It was March. It was March.
March of 21, I think.
Yeah, because it was part of that year of everything on HBO Max.
Yeah, day and date.
We'll see how it goes. I think just listening to you and the reviews, I think if it makes enough money, then you'll probably get another one. And again, since we are dealing with, kids, if they green light it, it'll probably be later this year. They'll probably start shooting no later than 26, but probably next year.
Yeah, it just all legitimately depends on what Reitman wants to do. Like, if they get the money and this one makes what the last one made, if not a little bit more, it'll all depend on Reitman and what direction he wants to go and whether or not he wants to direct the thing. By the way, this is also your reminder we're getting a Tron movie at some point with Jared Leto.
Yes, I forgot that was a thing. They released something a little while back. I completely
A
forgot about
picture of
that.
him. Yeah, a picture of him in the red suit. So Chad, like, Sony doesn't have a lot, and so they're eager to put these kind of things out there if they have a property that works. Men in Black is dead on arrival now after the Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth movie. 21 Jump Street is dead, never going to be revived. Spider-Man is co-signed by Marvel in the live action realm. And they keep putting out these live-action crappy Spider-Man villains movies, and they have a great animated two great animated movies revolving around the character. What is Sony's need? Does Sony need Ghostbusters to be a thing?
Yes, Sony very much needs Ghostbusters to be a thing. They need, in this franchise-driven world, their only franchise right now is Spider-Man. So they need other potential franchises with Spider-Man and actually Jumanji. Those two are the surefire franchises they have right now. So yes, they need Ghostbusters to do something. So I don't know what their answer is. I don't
Well,
know.
I mean, it's
Okay.
not that much different from Paramount, right? Like Paramount has Transformers and they have Star Trek, but they have Mission Impossible, and Mission Impossible is probably their leading franchise at this point, and that's seven movies in.
Yeah, but Paramount, I mean, yeah, that is true. But well, up until the last one, Mission Impossible was a steady bankroll that you can count on. They've also got the surprise of Top Gun, which if they touch it again, I would not be surprised. That makes so much money to bolster what they were doing. And then, yeah, Transformers, G.I. Joe, all that kind of stuff. The thing, and I guess Paramount really is like really similar to Sony, but the thing to me is when I think of Sony movies now, since I know there's so few of them in the franchise realm that comes out, I automatically don't think they're good. Like Ghostbusters, I'm willing to give a chance. I didn't really have an opinion going into it, but all the other big franchise movies that they have, my first thought is, this is not going to be good. With Paramount, I can compartmentalize and think, okay, I'm done with Transformers because I don't think any of those will be good until certain people are gone. And then when those people are gone, I come back. So I think that's the difference for me at least, is that Sony feels more like a surefire failure of a movie coming out if it doesn't have Spider-Man attached, whereas I think, and I'm pretty, and this is just anecdotal, and I'm off, but I don't think of them as automatic failures. I think they'll have to do some work, but I think they'll probably be good, where Sony's just going to be bad.
I think it's just interesting because I think if it does Afterlife numbers, they green light a sequel, and Reitman gets into the writer's room, and we, you know, and Ghost Core Productions pumps out another one in 2026, 2027. And I think that's a pretty good run because, again, the first two didn't get a sequel. Answer the Call clearly never got a sequel. So to get three full movies with the same cast, you know, would be a great thing for this franchise, I feel. And hopefully it would lead to other ancillary things like a rebirth of the animated series or, you know, expanded universe novelizations or something to keep it going after that.
Yeah, get that stuff on streaming is everything. Get that stuff on streaming. As far as I know, it's not streaming anywhere. I don't really look because I have the first season of the cartoon. So if I want to watch it, I have it.
This is our week, our almost every month reminder that the Ernest movies are not all in one place on streaming.
Yep, and this is why you should buy physical media, guys. And if you just like the ease of playing things from your couch, how about you get physical media, transfer it to your own server, and you can still do that kind of thing. Because then they can't take it away from you. Those Ernest movies Brian's talking about, I have them. Because I have physical media. Physical media, good. Streaming supplement, good. That's how this should be.
Indeed. Well, Chad, anything else in the world you wanted to cover before we wrap? Because I had a good experience with this movie. I will end up seeing it again before it leaves theaters. I'm hopeful.
No, and that is good to hear because I know how much you do care about Ghostbusters. So, and I want it to be successful. So I'm glad that, you know, mixed reviews and like decent money. I think we can work with that. As far as anything to cover, no. At some point, we'll probably talk about all this the DC news that has come out. Hopefully. Around the time they decide to show us what Superman looks like, I'm still here waiting, James. You said when production started, I would see Superman. I have not done it yet. I've not seen him yet. It's been almost a month. Get with the program, man. I want to see Superman.
Indeed. And this will be a daily thing on Twitter. If you follow Chad at the Mets Theory, you can see him consistently begging James Gunn to see Superman.
I kind of showed off the last couple of days, but I think I'm probably going to start up again because I just feel they have to do it within like the next 2 weeks because they're going to be going outside. And the minute they have to shoot outside is the minute we find out what Superman looks like. So I would rather them show me than Pavarotti pictures show me.
Indeed. So that'll about do it for this week's episode. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
I am at the aforementioned Mets Theory.
Thank you very much. And busting makes us feel good.
Ding it, ding it.